Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 65 of Dominario's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And today, at long last, the title of this podcast is no longer an incredibly obscure and overall pun. We are finally in a position to be judging Dominaria.
Yeah, Dominaria United is some degree of officially and semi-officially spoiled. By the time this episode goes up, it will probably be very close to completely spoiled, if not completely spoiled. We'll be back next week with some nice lists, but this week it's the absolute mess pile of random spoilers. And kind of just talking about a bunch of new cards and a bunch of different formats, or I guess two formats, unless you have Explorer thoughts.
We find excuses to touch on others here and there, but yeah, there's always some amount of spoiling ahead of time and leaking and so on that goes on during the preview season, and some amount of stuff being scooped out from underneath the people who were meant to officially spoil it. But this season, it's really a return to the days where, like, the entire god book for a set just got leaked somewhere, or it almost feels old school, I guess, in keeping with the history of Dominaria sets, in terms of just stuff being appearing on, like, Mythic Spoiler or whatever out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least it dates back in my mind to Judgment, which was the set where they, I believe, accidentally Magic Onlined the whole set before it released, and that was dicey.
And this is the very early days of Magic Online, too. This is 1.0, I assume, back in the very grainy UI days.
Yeah, in the Leaping Lizard original days, I believe. This, because the first sets on Magic Online were IPA 7th, so OTJ would be the next block. And then I think this was back when they had a select group of people beta testing the new set in advance on Magic Online. And that was the source of the leak or something like that. But it's not exactly clear, as opposed to the time that they handed out god books to people and they got leaked. Or the time where the last Dominaria set, they actually did this exact same thing where they accidentally uploaded the release notes and just, like, shared the entire set with everybody.
Yeah, incredibly fitting for our purposes that Judgment met this fate, and now Dominaria is as well 20 years later on this return visit. But a lot to sink our teeth into, and we'll give some big picture views of the set and its mechanics as a whole, as well as our views on individual cards. Before that, though, as always, we have some brief housekeeping to get to, and then the results of the Modern Challenges from the weekend. So we welcome Wing 2 Star to the... we don't have some, like, catchy collective noun yet for our patrons, but just our patrons. Welcome to the Goat Dodger himself, one of the more well-known and more well-known Magic Online grinders, and someone whose thoughts I'm very keen to hear whenever some, like, new wacky combo deck comes on the scene.
Yeah, regarding names, we could just be the Coalition. You know, that might be flavorfully appropriate, but I'll leave that to a future discussion.
I kind of like it, but what if people want to be the Phyrexians?
That's true. We might just need to have select, you know what, no, this involves, like, figuring out Discord's patron interface and having it work, and we'll get there.
Were you thinking we could do some, like, new Phyrexia versus Mirrored Impure thing, like split the Discord in two and then see which half of the Discord can battle for supremacy there?
Yeah, approximately that, yes.
You can, like, choose your Discord role or something. We'll workshop it. We'll figure it out. Anyway, the Saturday Modern Challenge, to return to our scheduled programming here. The top line, I guess, is a lot of Yawgmoth and a lot of creativity. So both decks which have been around the scene for a while and really cemented themselves at the center of the format over the past few weeks. And this is just one more data point on both of those fronts.
Yeah, those decks have been doing very well, even though this top eight was taken down by four color, like the Traverse build, and you see, like, it's a four color versus Is It Finals, very kind of expected. If you look down, I believe it's, like, half of the top eight is Creativity or Yawgmoth, and then, like, also Rakdos Scam deck popping up, putting up more top eight finishes for the, I guess, Rakdos Evoke, Rakdos Scam, choose your flavor of naming conventions, but... I'm a big fan of Rakdos Scam as the name, and it certainly is giving me reasons to say that every single week.
Mm-hmm. And then Creativity, actually the second most popular deck throughout this top 32 here. Two copies in the top 8 on Saturday, and three copies in the top 8 on Sunday, joining some good paper finishes as well at SCG Baltimore this weekend. So this deck, the talk of the town over the past few weeks, and no signs of shutting up anytime soon, I guess.
Yeah, it's... it had like a couple off weeks and then just kind of came back with a vengeance. I think some of it is like this. It's not entirely stock yet, but Fire Ice has been popping up and that's been a notable improvement. I think some of it may be just generally condensing the list, even though there is a persist list in the top eight. It feels largely settled that the list that is primarily like teamer and not really touching into black, except for like hard casting Archon and maybe a single persist in a flex slot, has become the more prominent one.
Yeah, it's at the point where when you see some of those early indications that you're facing the creativity deck, you can kind of pencil in the rest from there. And there's only a few flex slots to worry about that you might be surprised by. But for the most part, there is a stock list developing, which you should certainly be aware of, even if you're not planning to play it yourself, which maybe you should be at this point. I feel like it should certainly be in contention for any modern tournament.
Yeah, I mean, the deck is quite enjoyable, and it's relatively easy to pick up, has been my experience at least. Maybe that's just like a deck that suits me fairly well, but also at the same time, there's not a lot of like micro coordination, like rocket science stuff going on in a lot of the games. It's kind of just like, oh, I would like more than one Archon, so I'm going to wait a turn and cast a bigger Indomitable Creativity or something like that.
It certainly fits that template of decks that I enjoy playing. These, I guess you could call it a combo control deck, where you have those games where you just do your thing on turn 3 or turn 4 and pick up your free wins, overwhelm whatever opponent is in front of you. But you also have those games where you're trying to bob and weave around possible interaction to set up this one big turn built around your namesake card, and you're kind of nickel and diming them with your Dwarven Mind tokens, and you know, you're baiting them with a Planeswalker here or a Fable over here, and trying to pick your spot to force your thing through. And that to me, having that end game to build towards, even if the way you get there is kind of fluid, for whatever reason, that appeals more to me than the just like soupy, generic, play all the good cards approach to four color decks that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I just enjoy resolving Archon of Cruelty triggers, but also the games where like they wrath away two Archons and then die to like two Ren Pings, two Dwarf Tokens, and a Fire Ice, and they're just like, what happened to me? This was horrible. Yeah, I like those games a lot.
Yeah, I got to witness on the other side with my teammate Steve Nagy in the modern seat playing just the stock-ish four-color Traverse deck. We have these games against creativity where we felt really priced into using our Teferi to bounce the Archon that had just entered play, because what else are we going to do? But we also knew that five or six turns down the line, like, the game would extend to that point, and that Archon being recast and getting another set of triggers and all the value that would come with that was a very realistic prospect that we'd have to work through at some point.
Yeah. I think the one other thing I want to touch on in this event was the dueling copies of Azorius in the top 16 with not Wafo, but Mr. Coffee yet, and Nassif actually going back to Azorius control. And kind of interesting to see some of the splits. Both decks fairly heavy on Chalice, but Nassif is actually leaning into Narset Day's Undoing. Any thoughts on Narset in this current metagame?
I think this is the way that you take your four-color deck, you take your blue-white deck, which is meant to be all of the non-four-color opponents, and this is your Hail Mary. This is your outside-of-the-box approach to try and salvage that matchup. And I don't know if it's actually doing its job there. I haven't been able to catch the Steve stream and see if he's being able to trump any four-color opponents that way. But I do like having, as I said, that like combo control approach where, yeah, you can do the long grindy game thing where Narset is just a good, solid, proactive card in your control deck. And then sometimes you get this 1-2 haymaker punch, which can just win games out of nowhere. So if you're playing some other kind of a longer game combo deck like Creativity or even something like Amulet Titan, then there's this looming threat of I can't play this game that's built towards inevitability because they have that now. Because at some point, they're going to assemble Narset plus Day's Undoing, and the beauty of that combo is that the Narset is very good at assembling the Day's Undoing if it's not under any pressure.
Yeah, that's, as like a way to beat four color, that seems like at least a semblance of a plan, which is more than a lot of the other Azorius decks have had. It sounds like we both need to still put a little bit of time. I'm actually just now seeing that Wafo was further down in this top 32, sadly abandoning the Timeless Dragon, but I'm glad to say that Timeless Dragon did make an appearance in other lists, so maybe they just had more heart than him, which is why Mr. Coffeyette's in 9th and not in 24th.
The beauty of it is it's timeless. It will be back at some point, whether it's in Rapid Tapper's hands or Mr. Coffeyette's or someone else's, but this may be a case of once you figure out this trick or this aspect of the deck, it then becomes adopted by some other shell, whether it's, you know, you could imagine reverting back to like the Jeskai control decks with the Narset Days Undoing thing, or it would not shock me if this somehow got assimilated into some, you know, yet another sub-variant of four color down the line.
Yeah, I was going to say, this sounds like a set of cards that is good with Raghavan. I'm sort of envisioning the Pioneer deck that is like Thing in the Ice, which is, I guess, sort of Pioneers. We can discuss that in a different episode, but like plays a similar role of like a proactive threat that like is good. I don't know. Just does like a lot of the same kind of sweeping action as Raghavan in my mind, but that is often paired with Collective Defiance and Narset there. And I could see like Raghavan, Narset, Days Undoing showing up in Modern under a similar kind of paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you wanted to highlight from either the Saturday Challenge here or the Sunday Challenge?
Sunday Challenge, I believe, was fairly stock outside of, I believe, the... No, I'm misremembering what was in the winning Hammer list, but it was just like, you know, Hammer versus Is It in the Finals, another one of the super stock matchups, a million Archon decks, Rakdos Scam yet again. I am interested to see... So, one of the things I would like to note is that we've talked a lot about Yawgmoth doing well this weekend already, and Rakdos is one of the best decks against Yawgmoth. Just as much... Like, Dothi Voidwalker, huge problem for Yawgmoth, but also just, like, the Rakdos deck is the best deck at creating two Fury triggers in the same turn. So, that is one of the biggest problems for Yawgmoth, and I don't know if that matchup is winnable or not. It's really, really bad. It's not like Rhino's bad, because I think that the Rakdos deck has a higher fail rate, but it's not good.
Yeah, there's still going to be some number of games where the Black Red player is priced into keeping a hand that's like Raghavan, Undying Malice, and just other generic cards, and they just get bricked by one copy of Young Wolf. But this does not sound like an easy matchup or one that you would want to face. And as we've mentioned in the past, there is a big difference emerging between these creature decks, which can survive the first Fury trigger, and that's almost something which you have to survive at this point, and then decks that can survive the second Fury trigger. And if you look at a lot of the four-color lists, which are increasingly moving away from even the first copy of Fury, you know, that one is finally making its way out of the traverse build of the deck, then some of those decks are hard-capped at a single Fury trigger, if that. And you still have some of the elemental decks where that's something you have to worry about more. But, you know, for a deck like Yawgmoth, where you can shrug off the first Fury trigger, the second one is what gets you, whether it's via Ephemerae or, I guess, Undying Malice and all of the different variants of that card now, then that is something to be conscious of.
Yeah, it really is actually transforming what a specific card is capable of doing. And it's, I think also, I don't know, it depends on where Izzet is going in the metagame. The less Izzet, the better for Rakdos. And I think that Izzet is at least, it feels like, trending down a small amount. We might get to some of that discussion in the talk about like the Star City results and like a bit of a splintering there. But as that deck trends down, expect decks like Rakdos to do a little bit better.
One thing I did want to highlight from Sunday is two copies of Hardened Scales in the 5 and 2 deck list here, I think 15th and 19th. And this is a deck which I've had my eye on a little bit, noting the return of Hammer to the top tables. And in the past, the question was, when would you want to play Hardened Scales over Hammer? It seems like Hammer is fundamentally more of a sound deck. We threw some reasons back and forth there. I think one reason that is emerging here is that if you think there is an Urza Saga-shaped hole in the format for whatever reason, then Scales is both a very good Saga deck, but it's better at finding Saga via Ancient Stirrings, and crucially, it's also a Biseidu deck. And I think that is a really big pickup in the Hammer pseudo-mirror, and I don't know if it's enough to actually fit the matchup, but you can happily run two or even three copies of Biseidu, find those reasonably consistently via Ancient Stirrings, and it's just an on-color mana source in your deck. You get the discount via Zabaz as well. And that's just a nice thing, which, I mean, the card is also very good against you, but I think that's a nice way to just buy back some equity for free, essentially, against some of the harder matchups in the format.
Yeah, I think that there's a, like, sub-question here of, like, also, how many dress downs and Force of Vigors do you expect? And Force of Vigor is on a definite downswing. Dress Down is on a moderate... I don't actually know, like, it feels like it's not popping off the way it could be, because I think that people have moved a lot more towards engineered explosives against Hammer, which I think favors the Scales deck, because its costs are a little more spread between like 0, 1, and 2. And like the way Modular works, it's very hard to like engineered explosives out an Arcbound Ravager. This is actually like a 20-year-old problem that is continuing to this day. So, yeah, just keep an eye on those two specific hate cards if you're looking at Hardened Scales.
Yeah, or if you think the format is in a place where some colorless cyborg card, some hate piece is useful, so Chalice of the Void against three different Cascade decks, for example, then Agent Stirring just as a way to have more access to that, I think is a really big deal. But there's not really another good shell for Agent Stirrings at this point, other than, I guess, Mono Green Tron, kind of, but that has a very specific role in mind for its Stirrings, and is also not that great at sideboarding in these cards to have access to with that card on the other end.
Yeah, and that deck's position is, like, also, I think that the Scales deck is better at stealing games off of the unfair decks that don't lose to Karn the Great Creator than the Tron deck is. Like, the Tron deck is very fragile if the unfair deck just puts up one piece of interaction, because it takes so much for it to undo that. This is like the classic Reman versus Tron issue. And Scales is a little more resilient if your opponent tries to like get in the trenches with you, and also like has a very fast actual clock as opposed to like a Karn clock that Belcher might just power through. Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's log off, I suppose, and go to the, I think it's the Legacy Master Series in Copenhagen that took place this past weekend as well, where if you were not aware that this event was happening, then don't worry about it. Not many people were. And there is one of these coming up in Paris in, I think, 3 weeks, which just announced its venue. So not sure how many more of these we will see in the future. It feels like there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that needs to be ironed out there, to say the least. But we do have the top eight deck list from this event. Titan Shift, of all things, taking this one down. The rest of the top eight, a little more in line with what you'd expect.
Yeah, I think the more important thing to mention from this is that it was like a 500-person two-day event, much like a classic Grand Prix. And I think that this is a interesting counterpoint to a discussion that's been had a lot online, which is just like, four color is winning everything in paper. And the answer is like, four color is winning a lot of like smaller events where the metagame can't fold in on it. And like, even though you see four color in the top eight here, like there's one copy that made the finals and got smushed by Titan Shift, and like the other four color deck in the top eight is Titan Creativity and not like a normal four color deck. And even like, I guess Glimpse is like a four color deck that's not four color, and Elementals is like vaguely a four color deck at these days compared to like the traverse versus not traverse debate. So I think that a lot of that is sort of artificial and baked in from like the way a lot of the tournaments people experience right now are structured, and in like Magic Online challenges where people are more likely to play a metagamed deck or react to the metagame, or like in these long events, I don't think four color has quite the tier zero dominance it sort of appears in these like six round with top eight events.
This made me think of a Twitter thread by Kyle Bogomies recently, who said that it seems like whenever he logs on, all he sees are people saying that they won their RCQs with the four color list with Traverse that Daryl had been advocating and posting this extensive and impressive primer for. And I think that does match my experience too. Like I see a lot of those same posts, and that does kind of match what you're saying here, where in a local metagame where there's going to be some amount of just random nonsense, of course, and you're going to have to maybe fade the one or two people who show up with the Titan Shifts and the Belgers of the world. But if you can rely on the rest of the tournament almost sifting those people out for you, then past a certain point, like you are just there in a more narrow, well-defined field with one of the best decks at beating up on that field. And so if you are one of the better players in the room, and maybe there's some kind of selection bias here with the people who you see posting that they're winning their tournaments with four color, then maybe you just get to convert on that pretty easily.
Yeah, I would caution against declaring four color a tier zero deck. It is strong, but it is like very beatable and not winning everything in the way it would be if it was actually that good.
Yeah, I saw Cedric Phillips saying that full color is just clearly the best thing to be doing, and putting his money where his mouth is in the Modern 5K at SCG Baltimore this weekend. And it seemed like this is the kind of deck which he's playing because he knows it's the best deck, but is not traditionally in his wheelhouse. And so I went over in the middle of the tournament to ask him if he was having fun, not realizing that at that very moment, he was marking to four against a burn player. So did not pick my spot especially well there. But he said yes anyway. So even in the height of garbage time, he was still having some fun and friendly magic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you mentioned him showing up to this tournament. And I scrolled over to the top eight, which is a good segue into this. And I don't see Cedric. I see one four-color deck in the top eight, losing in the top eight. And the rest of the top eight is like, Yawgmoth, is it? And actually, a very interesting deck in the finals. Looks like Lotus Field Storm is showing back up there. But yeah, I guess Lotus Field Breach, Storm, whatever like the Twiddle deck really is these days. Not really like a... This is like an expected, unexpected top eight aside from the two Is It decks.
Yeah, this Breach deck, the Lotus Field Twiddle Storm deck, was something that I know the Seven Shoots and Will Kruger team was actually strongly considering for the mocks, specifically to beat up on the four-color decks that they expected to show up there, and hoping to fade the Murktai decks, which they expected those four-color decks, in turn, to be pushing out of that tournament. And so this is the kind of dynamic we spoke about before, where maybe it's not always Twiddle Storm, maybe it's Calibrated Blast, which we saw in the top eight once again of one of these challenges this weekend. Maybe it's Belcher, maybe it's Titan Shift, what have you. But there's this whole contingent of decks which are very good at the specific task of beating up on four color, and not especially good at anything else, but some of them just have this, they have a certain amount of raw power, and they can steal games in any matchup and so on. And so, you know, some amount of the time, you see these decks convert on that. And we have Is It Murktide in third and fourth place. So this Twiddle Storm deck had to get through at least one of those to make it to the final set.
Yeah, I'm about to check these sideboards, and because I didn't do a Blood Moon count, I would assume, oh, two each. Okay, so they got to fade that and also fade everything else about Murktide. So that's kind of promising. I do like this as another spot where Leyline of Sanctity is very applicable, the same way it is in Living End. Like, this is a deck that is also weak against Endurance and also weak against Discard, and like having a card that covers both of those at the same time is pretty great.
Yeah, I think Alpine Moon is, if anything, as big a deal, if not more so, than the various other moons are floating around. And you honestly don't see that card much more either. It feels like people are trying to attack the Urza Saga decks in other ways, whether it's Engineered Explosives or Dress Down or what have you, neither of which really do anything against this Underworld Breach deck. And so if there's none of the cheap moon effects, and sometimes you just win turn three on the play before the other moon effects have time to do their thing, then maybe you get to dodge that. When we talk about Underworld Breach, we should actually mention the Grinding Breach deck, which Ross Merriam won an RCQ with and then got second in the team open in Baltimore with as well in the Modern Sea. So this is a deck that's picking up a little bit of steam again as well.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was referring to when I was talking about a potential split in the Is It players. I am not, like, so I'm currently in a league with this deck because I don't understand it. I'm 3-0, and I still do not understand it. Like, not literally as we are talking, but, like, I started last night and gotten a couple matches. And as far as I can tell, it is literally that Urza Saga-sized hole in the metagame where, like, there is a hole for an Urza Saga deck that does anything else besides be hammer and be vulnerable to a bunch of cheap removal. And that has me really questioning whether that is a role that this deck is supposed to be playing, or whether you're just supposed to be like, I don't, like, some Asmo deck that has Expressive Iteration would be my immediate thought, because that was the other amazing card. Because, like, every hand I draw with this deck that has combo pieces feels bad unless it has all of the combo pieces. Like, I don't know. Underworld Breach and Grinding Station are not friends. That's just not how you play Magic. But, like, the hands where I'm just like, yeah, Raghavan, Urza Saga, Underworld Breach, that's just great. That's all good cards doing good stuff. And, like, I don't quite know. Also, this is a... I'm going to go on a Ledger Shredder rant. I think that Ledger Shredder is... and this is also related to a tweet that Jerry Thompson put out today that's basically just, like, Thing in the Ice is better than Ledger Shredder. And I'm assuming that's in the context of, like, Pioneer, is it? I think that that is 100% true in the Phoenix decks. I think it is. This is another case where I don't think Shredder is that great here either. There's just this inherent aspect of Shredder where, like, you aren't gaining, immediate material to do stuff. You're just, like, filtering cards away and making a medium threat under the promise that, like, you will continue to filter cards away with it. And it just implies that you are interested in playing a game that extends itself. And this deck is not interested in doing that, as far as I can tell. I kept drawing these hands with the combo of Ledger Shredder and Urza Saga. And it's just like, okay, so I'm just going to play a 1-3 flyer. I'm going to chip in with my Concordia Pegasus and make some constructs. And then they're just going to take 20 damage from artifact creatures. Like, what is Ledger Shredder even doing? I don't think it's horrible here. Like, it clearly serves a role. But I think it's, like, one of the worst cards in the deck.
Yeah, I think that might be the true combo of the deck, if anything, is Urza Saga and Ledger Shredder. But that's not a great combo. And it makes me wonder if there's some other shell that can support both Urza Saga and just some big dumb idiot that is not vulnerable to the traditional Urza Saga countermeasures. So I almost want to go back to like Boomer Jund or something, where maybe Urza Saga and Tarmogoyf is the combo that Modern is waiting for again.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a way to play those with Iteration and not just lose to Murktide Regents. That would be my thought, is like, I want Urza Saga, Iteration, and some big dumb idiot. My other thought about this list is I think that the main deck Prismatic Ending is, like, actively bad. I think that you are often in spots where your life total is very relevant, and, like, I don't think you want your main deck configuration to leave anything up in the air as to whether you should be fetching a white source or not. I think that that is, like, that corner case is a, like, you either have to play as if the ending is not in your deck until it is in your hand, or, like, you just lose so much life a game for no upside. So I don't really know if it adds a lot. Unless I'm like, maybe the odds of just having it in your hand later and like not being able to cast it are low enough that you just don't care and you just pretend it's not in your deck. But that's just like a dilemma that came up while playing that I'm just like, I'm just going to pretend it's not there. Why is it actually here?
Do you think you could build this Grinding Beat Shell in some other ways, bearing in mind the criticisms you've had of it so far?
No, I think the problem is that Grinding Station and Mox Amber are just not great cards, and like Underworld Breach is sometimes a divination. I think that that's just a lot of material to dedicate to the combo, and like in the end it's like a 2.5 card combo to really get started. You can like Station plus Bauble, but like that's a 4-mana setup, right, where you, like, have the Station, play the Breach, start going with Bauble, and, like, you have to, like, have other... There's a lot of setup. I don't know the exact counts on, like, cards in Graveyard, but it is not the cleanest to do off low resources. So, like, you're starting to get to the point where, unless you have a very specific 3 or 4 card setup, your combo is, like, extending through a lot of your deck and most of your hand, and it's just not super exciting. So I don't think these are the cards I would want, which is why I suggested the Asmo cards, because the Asmo stuff is like fairly self-contained and not cross-dependent if you build it right, at least in my opinion.
Does the right build of that contain like Feasting Troll King or Time Sieve, or where are we looking here?
I think that the less of those cards you play, the better. I think that this is like probably almost an iteration on the like Vampires deck that I was messing around with late last year, where I was just like, I have Voldaren Epicure and like Angie in my deck, and it just like at the end of the day I was just like, no, I'm just like reanimating some Blood Gas and killing my opponent with like Blood Gas constructs and like a single activation Asmo, and like that's the kind of deck I want to build, where like I have Urza Saga, but if they kill Saga I'm also bashing with like some graveyard threat and Asmo, and then like Raghavan or whatever, and like it just all sort of comes together.
Yeah, maybe the answer is something like the Dimir Asmo decks, but without the Time Sieve endgame, or just playing more generically solid cards. I could see that being a good idea. The point you mentioned about preserving your life total being important, the winning team in this tournament did have Burn in their Modern seat. Not sure if Ross lost to that player or not. I guess you can go back and watch and check that for yourself on Anurag Das's Twitch channel, twitch.tv/RTDMDG, who has been doing, frankly, phenomenal work giving some coverage of these tournaments effectively as a one-man operation. And this is what coverage looks like in this day and age. And if you want there to be tournament coverage, then you have to support the people who are doing it. And right now, that is Anurag. So send your time and your dollars his way, because it's not cheap and it's not easy. And it's a labor of love for him personally. And he deserves all the support he can get there.
Yeah, the guerrilla coverage era of Magic is a disappointment and a delight at the same time. And I'm currently in the delight stage.
Yes, and if we want to have it keep being delightful, then I've got to do our part there as well. My SUG Baltimore experience, we can touch on that quickly. So I was in the Pioneer Sea, ended up settling on the Heroic deck. I know this was one of the several recommendations that you threw around last week, and I was pretty impressed in my short sample preparing with it as well. And then when I was just looking around at the trials on Friday, the players are playing for buys, which almost feels like a foreign concept at this point. There was so much mono green that it seemed like hard targeting that would be the smart thing to do. And the consensus goes that Heroic is the deck that the best does that. I am less convinced now, having played the tournament, that that is actually the case. I think that your matchup against just normal stock mono green is still pretty good, although still very play draw dependent and still very swingy in a way that makes it hard to really pin down how good the matchup actually is. But the devotion decks that have these small splashes, whether it's White for Portable Hole or the real nightmare is Black for Fatal Push and Vraska, which is an approach that had kind of been cycled through and then moved past because, you know, Teferi Who Slows the Sunset or what have you was the new hotness. But Corey Baumeister had been touting this Pioneer deck, which was the deck he was most excited about that he'd ever played in a tournament, and you can find hear all about it on his Patreon. And I was this close to firing off the $5 just to see what that is. Turns out it was just green devotion splashing black, and so I got to experience firsthand just how important those changes are in this matchup specifically, but I think across the board, where if you look at a lot of the problem cards for green devotion in the format, or a lot of the cards that decks are leaning on as part of their plan against mono green, a lot of them getting sniped by Vraska on the third turn is just often that's lights out right there, even if the game continues for a while. So after this tournament, I was a lot less convinced in the Heroic deck than I was coming in. I was more reassured about that specific build of mono green, and it felt like I'm not sure how you're really meant to attack that version of the deck at this point, other than maybe going even more all in with your build of green devotion and just hoping to be more proactive in the mirrors.
Yeah, that is a fair concern. There may be a couple other spots. Like, I'm thinking, like, that sounds like the deck is slightly clunkier and more exploitable by, like, mono blue spirits, like, less interactive decks that are pushing down that angle, but also able to interact. Or, that's kind of a silly way to say it. Decks that that are not playing into the green deck's creatures, but, like, also have ways to interact with their explosive draws. Yeah, I'm just, like, skimming through the Pioneer Challenge results to see if there's anything else that meets what I'm talking about. I don't quite know exactly what I'd be looking for in that space. I do want to shout out, I've really started enjoying the Rakdos Sacrifice deck, though I have been told that the mono-green matchup is not the best. I think a lot of the other things the deck is doing are really powerful. It's gotten a lot better than it was when I had last played it. Like, the lists are just, like, very cohesive these days, and very capable of just, like, playing good Magic. And it's a lot of, like, bean counting pings and life totals, but, like, I have really enjoyed that play pattern.
I'm curious what you think about the build that top 8ed a challenge courtesy of Omar Belden, which is essentially Rakdos Sacrifice splashing green at the top end for Korvold. Because one issue that I had with the previous builds of the deck was it felt like you could churn through a bunch of your deck with Deadly Disputes and Unlucky Witnesses, but there just wasn't anything to churn towards. Like, it was just a bunch of air turning into more air. And I guess unless you found one of your four Mayhem Devils in a matchup where that was the thing you cared about in the first place or what have you, often you were just spinning your tires, not doing anything. Whereas with Korvold, you kind of work towards this point in the game where you land that thing and now suddenly you just go completely ballistic.
So I think that in the matches I've played at least, which isn't like a ton, but it's enough, I think that I have been maybe very focused on like getting in those chip shots so that like turning into a late Mayhem Devil always is good enough because it's like, oh, I have like two food, a cauldron familiar, and like an oven and like something else, and it's just like, oh, my opponent's just gonna take like 8 damage here if they don't immediately kill this, and then also I have, like, all this other stuff back. I have had the experience where, like, that is the game I want to play, where, like, very close to, like, the Lingering Souls Blood Artist-style decks, as opposed to, like, board control. Like, you board control in the board control matchups, but, like, in the matchups where you need a way to deal damage that is not, like, weirdo chip shots or your Mayhem Devil isn't clearing out the board, Ob is just the best way to start your, like, route towards a burn-them-out game plan. And it feels like every single game is ended by, like, 5 to 10 points of direct damage.
One other development that came out of this tournament was Pioneer Indomitable Creativity 2. We'd seen the Rakdos approach pioneered by Julian Wellman, and then we saw an Is It Creativity deck where you're trying to creativity for two into Xenagos and Worldspine Worm, but this time it's just backed up with the various blue cards. So this 8 creativity team was, I think, the first seed, or one of the highest seeds going to the top 8, and then top 6, I suppose. And they seem very happy with that choice in both formats. And so one of their creativity players bought out a lot of the creativity in the room and was going around selling them at face price to his friends on the grounds that, well, this card is going to spike if it also becomes one of the top decks in Pioneer 2. And so I was convinced / tricked into buying a set on that basis. And it doesn't sound like a bad investment, honestly.
Yeah, that card is getting better and better by the day, basically. It is... I'm looking at this Is It list for the first time, because I hadn't looked at the Pioneer Top 8 decks here. This looks like a successor to the decks that have been banned and then, like, re-existed in Standard. There's, what, 7 big score unexpected windfalls, and, like, just going down that road, and it happens that creativity is the best way to win the game. Yeah, I don't have a lot of thoughts on this list besides, like, it just looks like the stuff you've seen in Standard before, which may be a bigger topic of discussion of, like, what Pioneer is now versus, like, what you could potentially do with it. But I need to play with or against this deck to feel out whether I think Big Score is a Pioneer viable card.
I think the big scores become better in the games where you find an excuse to sideboard out your main combo in favor of the, like, Hullbreaker Horrors or Nezahals or Niv-Mizzet Perunes or whatever your big idiot is for the blue mirrors, because at that point your big score is not just replacing itself and cycling through and creating some creativity fodder. It is actually giving you the resources to play this big haymaker and seize control of the game that way. And we've seen that play pattern in the historic creativity decks in the past, and that is an old hat at this point.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that you can, like, the horrors are not necessarily, like, you can sideboard into them as a plan instead of creativity, but you can also sideboard them in alongside creativity in matchups where, like, just resolving a horror is good enough, but also you aren't getting contested on your creativity's resolving as much, and, like, you just don't want to draw a Xenagos or a Worldspine Worm, but, like, I don't know, creativity for one and, like, Fiery Impulse something cleans up the game. That's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then in Legacy, to close out this briefly, we had Jarvis there playing Nia Depths, which I think was a good choice for the tournament, achieved its intended role of beating up on the Izzet decks. The one snag that we encountered was people in paper love their Tundras. There's always going to be some amount of blue control decks in Legacy, and that typically is the nightmare matchup for Nia Depths. That being said, Minsk and Boo was one of the big developments in the format coming into this tournament, which you couldn't really stress test on Magic Online because it doesn't exist there yet. I hear that is changing in the near future, but both that and Maddening Hex, which is a staple of Izzet Delver and, like, Izzet mid-range sideboards in paper, that doesn't exist on the platform either. So you had these two recent cards, which both are shaking up the format in a pretty real way, that you just had to take on good faith for people who had played more paper Legacy than you, that those were actually as effective as advertised.
Yeah, Minsk and Boo, I don't know. I think you can just read the card and be like, oh, this is pretty messed up. But I think the other one, I don't have any insight onto that.
It's weird because it's great in... It's flippant to say it's good when people are casting non-creature spells, but it is. But you never know quite how good. And so you can assume that, okay, against, like, a Storm deck or what have you, just mathematically, they have to cast enough spells that they can't actually fade the consequences of this unless they just hit once every time and you and get full like reverse Yahtzee on you. But how good is it against a control deck or like an 8-cast deck or something? That's kind of hard to gauge at a glance. And you have to see it in action over a larger sample size to really get a good sense for that. And that's where the inability to test on Magic Online really comes into play there. Minsk and Boo, yeah, as you say, you read it and you know that the card is messed up, but it's not apparent how messed up or some of the ways in which you can attack it. So I saw a lot of players like fail to respond to the ETB trigger that creates the Boo hamster token with a lightning bolt, because you normally you play a planeswalker, you get to use its loyalty uptick ability immediately. With Minsk and Boo, because of that trigger, you can't do that. So starts on 3 loyalty, you have this window to bolt it down, which is a big part of why it's not actually an effective card in the double matchup, and that is actually, I think, the limiting factor that stops it from being more popular in the first place. And then, because the token is legendary, the card Caracas lines up very well against it. So it indexed like Death and Taxes, you know, that's another reason to lean towards those. But even in something like the Nia Depths deck, where you can wasteland opposing Caracases, and you can have consistent access to your own Caracas via all of your crop rotation, Elvish Reclaimer effects. So Minsk is a card that really swings these blue mirrors and the Depths matchup against the blue decks. And now you see people trying to respond to that card specifically. So, you know, the Hydro Blast, for example. You know that one is already earmarked for stuff like the Izzet decks, but against these blue mirrors now, or even against Nia Depths, where it's countering their Pyroblast effects and also their biggest threat, you can start to realistically consider sideboarding that card in. And so if you think back to the days when you know, Miracles was the best deck, and any like bigger planeswalker that could dodge both Counterbalance and Pyroblast was automatically gotten audition. So like Gideon Ally of Zendikar was a legacy staple for a while. Minsk and Boo has fit seamlessly into that role, but some of the level 2.5 cards that were already in your sideboard anyway are actually quite effective against it.
Yeah, maybe it's, you know, you got to have those Veil of Summers instead of the Red Blast to go with it. You know, just like mix it up against their Blast. Oh gosh, this is why I don't think about Legacy.
Lots of reasons not to think about Legacy, frankly. But let's not think about Legacy anymore. Let's think about some exciting new cards that are coming down the pipeline in just a few weeks here. So where do we want to get started?
I think we should start with an old card, and that's Liliana of the Veil. As far as I can tell, this is the best card in the set by, like, an absolute mile. I don't know if you agree or disagree. I think this card... I think there was a poll recently about whether it will be banned in Pioneer. I think that is absolute nonsense, but it's definitely going to change the format.
Yeah, no way it gets banned, but I think it will see a lot of play. I think initially some amount of that will be driven by nostalgia or fun memories of its time in Standard, or hey, I already am playing Rakdos Midrange and this seems like the perfect home for it, so let's slot that one in and see how it goes. I don't know how much staying power it will have, and I don't think it's going to be necessarily an automatic 4-off in that deck, or if it's going to actually like revitalize other black midrange, black control shells and make them good. But I think the card is a great case study in how Magic has changed in the more than a decade since it was first printed, where this is the thing holding people back, I believe, where in a world where every single card, it seems, is everything everywhere all at once, then Liliana and specifically the Edict effect trading for like some fraction of that is not the automatic charm that it used to be, where, you know, you could Fatal Push their turn 2 play and then Liliana Edict their turn 3 play, and now you have a planeswalker sticking around as a relevant game piece. They're left on nothing, and you can take control of the game from there.
Yeah, I'd like to make the counter argument that like I don't know how the Heroic deck ever defeats this card. I don't know, like, I think that in a lot of games of the Rakdos Mirror, whoever resolves this card is going to be way ahead. I mean, the bottom, like the floor on this card is probably playing against any Treasure Cruise deck with it. So that may prompt a resurgence of those decks, which is sort of like an interesting dilemma, because like you then have this debate of like, well, Graveyard Trespasser and Liliana can't really work together, so maybe you like load up on Hearses, which I guess also makes you better. Yeah, maybe that's just what happens, because it's better against Liliana in the mirrors to have a hearse, because they can't really, like, you could follow up with a creature and just crack into the Liliana, so there's not, like, a good way around that. So maybe that's just kind of what we see, is a lot more Liliana and a lot more Unlicensed Hearth showing up.
Yeah, I think those decks that are trying to make a big investment in one creature will have to adapt or die when it comes to this card. So if people are playing, you know, auras, decks of some description, right? I think the card Carthusa Solidarity massively rises in value in a format where Liliana exists now. And, you know, you'll see small adaptations like that. More broadly speaking, I think it actually is not that bad against a Treasure Cruise deck in the sense that it forces them to have a Treasure Cruise in order to keep up with this relentless assault on their hand, where between, you know, Kroxa, Liliana, targeted discard like Thoughtseize, and then potentially in your sideboard, maybe there's Goblanks or what have you, then I think that it's pretty hard for them to just keep anything around at that point. And you might be able to, like, force them to use the first Treasure Cruise just to stay at parity, and then you can grind through the rest. But more broadly speaking, you look at, like, Liliana against the mono green decks, for example, where on the play, sometimes you Liliana down their thing, and then you have a removal spell for their follow-up, and it's effectively lights out. Other times, they have, you know, an old growth troll, you Liliana that, and they're almost welcome. They're glad that you did that, because now that turns their troll into a ramp spell that then casts their Cavalier or what have you. So I think it exacerbates a lot of the play versus draw differences that already exist in the format, and I don't know if the play patterns of the card are that inspiring, even if just on raw power level, it probably has what it takes still.
Yeah, uninspiring play patterns is certainly a hallmark of Liliana over the years, so not shocked at all by that description. Yeah, the card's really good. If your deck is bad against it in Pioneer, you should really think more about playing, like, what you're doing against Liliana. Expect to see a lot of it. It is going to live up to at least a decent portion of the hype. I don't have a lot to add beyond that because we've been playing against the card for a million years and, like, it's been doing its thing.
Yeah, I'm almost happy to see the card back solely because it's a card which is trying to shrink the game rather than just creating this snowballing avalanche of resources where both players, like, never run out of cards and, you know, we have these increasingly bigger games. I think it's nice having a pushed reason to try and move in the opposite direction, even if that card by itself is maybe not especially compelling. I think as well, we might see what we saw the first time around, where Liliana wasn't that effective in Standard for most of its lifespan there, but it was format-defining in Modern at that time, certainly less so now, but I wonder if we're going to see a similar thing again, where it's going to be a big deal in Pioneer, and maybe not that effective in Standard in the face of, like, Liliana versus Wedding Announcement, right? Like, that's not a matchup I want to be facing. Or Liliana versus Fable of the Mirror Breaker, which I imagine will still be a format-defining card post-rotation. I think a lot of the cards that are priced to move for Standard just naturally line up pretty well against Liliana.
Yeah, I mean, also, another card that comes to mind is, like, being good against Liliana that may have implications, not necessarily with it, but with similar stuff in Pioneer, is Oni Cult Anvil, and, like, just the general lineup of, like, one of the reasons Liliana was not even that good in Standard was because you would have to play against Doom Traveler X percentage of the time, or, like, Stranglegeist Geist or Thragtusk, and, like, all of these, like, cards that inherently just wanted to die to the sacrifice. And I could see that being a problem for it moving forward in Standard. And I could see just, like, I don't know, Liliana versus Unlucky Witness and Cauldron Familiar. Good luck. Being a portion of the card's problems in a couple months in Pioneer, once everything else shakes out.
Yeah, I imagine in Standard, like, 4 Liliana, 4 Mihawk Massacre is going to be a good starting point for some kind of black midrange deck, but, and those two cards do complement each other quite nicely, but yeah, I think that Liliana's strength is more contextual than abstract. That's a good place for a Planeswalker to land. So we'll see how that context shakes out in a few months from now. Let's move on to some of the new cards here. And the first one I think people want to touch on is Temporary Lockdown. So this is one white for an enchantment. When it ETBs, you exile all non-land permanents with converted mana cost or mana value two or less until this leaves the battlefield. So it's a mass banishing light, if you like, or like a Culling Ritual attached to that kind of template.
Yeah, and I think that the important part is that, like, Culling Ritual has a lot of problems because the buy-in cost is four across multiple colors, and this is just, like, single color, three mana, very easy to set up. Also, like, notably good with Yorion, because you just kind of put their stuff back and then take it all away later.
Yeah, that's actually a really nice interaction where typically with a single shot effect like a portable hull, sometimes you hold that turn one play and then later Yorion can upgrade that hull to hit something which is now more important. With this, you don't even have to choose. You know, everything that was snagged by the lockdown the first time goes right back into jail when it comes back at the end of your turn. So I imagine the blue-white decks with Yorion are going to have an automatic interest in this card. And it's the type of thing which I think does scale well with the size of a format where you're able to build these decks full of 1-drops and 2-drops that all get swept up by this, as opposed to standard where maybe it's still going to be a good card. But if, you know, if the pacing of a standard format is defined by the 3-drops and the 4-drops, then there's a limit to how good this can be. So in Pioneer, this is a great response to like the Rakdos Sacrifice decks, for example, or any deck like Heroic or Auras or stuff like that. And then when you get to Modern, you're looking at Hammer decks. You're going to hate to see this. And then I don't know if there's anything which really is going to be scared of this beyond that, or any natural home for this card, but a good thing to have in the toolbox.
Yeah, I think that the notable things beyond the Hammer decks, I was just like skimming through and thinking this through. I think that this card is actually like fairly effective against Yawgmoth, because a lot of their cheap stuff is very important in building them towards their more expensive stuff actually working, and also hard to kill. So this card is going to be like reasonably effective there. But also the thing that's notable is that against Hammer, it kills all the Saga tokens. So there are a million other Urza Saga decks that this card is just going to cover basically everything they're doing. Like against Amulet, it cover, like if the rest of your deck is built to be somewhat controlling, it covers their fast Amulet draws and their Urza Saga draws, which is kind of great. It's also just like baseline can handle a Renin 6. This card is just like a little better than it looks as just like a normal functional card in Modern, I think.
I think the issue against Saga in general is that there will be times where, let's say, they have a Saga on 2 that's ready to start activating, and you feel obliged to pull the trigger on this on your turn, and then, because if you don't, then them making a construct and then making another construct and then fetching something, like that's going to spell doom for you right there. So you have to do this now, but then you're opening yourself up to this scripted response of, well, end of turn, I'll make a construct and then do the usual Urza Saga thing. And now, even after your sweeper, they have 2 constructs and then whatever the Saga found on the way out, plus whatever else they followed up with to contend with as well. So like, it cleans up part of the first wave, but then Saga itself can sometimes just represent the entire second wave.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the case of Saga versus any single sweeper, that like, you're right, going to either have to eat a construct hit or like accept that Urza Saga is going to Urza Saga.
Yeah, barring something like a Pernicious Deed with that exact timing and wording and so on, then that's just always going to be an issue there. Let's move on to Runvelt Hordemaster. So this is in a set with a few different tribal incentives that are worth talking about. This is, I think, the most exciting one we've seen so far. So this is 1 and a red for a goblin. I'll make sure I get the exact wording here. So your other goblins get +1/+1. And then when a goblin you control, another goblin you control dies, or boy, I think it applies to this. Yes, it applies to this too. Then you exile the top. Okay, let me
exile the top card of your library. If it's a goblin, you may cast that card until the end of your next turn. So this is not the wording that we've seen the last couple sets with like Witness, where it's like until your next end step, where like if it dies on your turn, you have to use it then. This is like the very classic like Reckless Impulse, light up the stage wording, where it's like you're gonna get an untap step to untap and cast that card. So this card is really good versus a lot of sweepers out of goblins, but I think the scary part of it is that it pairs really well with Skirk Prospector.
Yeah, so if the name Dirty Kitty means anything to you, then first of all, you're very old, so congratulations. But secondly, this is the perfect way to revitalize a show like that, where, so for the uninitiated, this was a combo goblin deck from Extended, you know, 15 years ago, where you had Fecundity. So whenever a creature died, you would draw a card. And so you would like cycle through your deck with Skirk Prospector, playing goblins, drawing more goblins, sacrificing those for mana, keeping the chain going. You would build up resources with Morgue War Marshal in that role, which would like become this Dark Ritual plus Ancestral Recall, and just keep the cycle going until you build towards this big finish. And in that context, this is a tutorable Fecundity, which also pumps all of your other smaller goblins and furthers this fair backup plan. and it's just like the best possible version you could ask for of that effect.
Yeah, I'm currently just staring at the Modern Horizons 2 printing of Patriarch Spitting, just willing that back into existence.
Yeah, and this card is also very good in just a generic Goblin deck. Even if the highest ambition that you have is just to play some Goblins and attack with your Goblins, this is very good at letting you attack with your Goblins.
Yeah, it's also very good with, like, a lot of the secondary Goblins tools that we have seen in the Conspicuous Snoop decks. So, like, Sling Gang Commander plus this card, like, not even Prospector, Sling Gang with this card is a lot. Just a lot of power and, like, also drawing a million cards. Yeah, just really good.
Yeah, there's a lot of sacrifice-themed Goblin stuff that you can build around in Modern. So you have the like, Dirty Kitty 4 combo kind of stuff, but you also have, as you mentioned, Sling Gang Lieutenant, Pashalik Mons as well. You can do the Undying thing with, like, Putrid Goblin and stuff like that. So a lot of ways to build around that. And what I love about this card is that I expect it to show up in a lot of different formats in different Goblins decks, but those decks will all be doing something very different with it. So in Pioneer, there was a Goblins deck that was just flooding the board with Goblin tokens, like Battlecry Goblin and Reckless Bushwhacker and so on. This fits in pretty nicely there. And then you jump to the other end of the spectrum in something like Legacy. Well, this is, you know, this lets your Goblin lackey attack through a Dragon's Rage Channel or something on turn one and get the party started.
Yeah, just a, like, an all-around very promising card. Like, I think the other thing that's really great is that it's just, like, good. Like, they bolt this, and you're just like, okay, I draw half a card. That kind of, like, very, like, low-key value that it represents, even when it's not, like, going off in a big way, is just really huge.
I think the concern I have is the same thing which has worried me about the various Goblin decks in Modern is, your curve is not really low enough to get maximum advantage out of an effect like this, where ideally, you see this with the, like, Unlucky Witness stuff going on in the Pioneer Sacrifice decks. You want your curve to be as low as possible so that you can cast whatever you flip with it in that narrow timing window and then do whatever else you plan to do on that turn. In Goblins, the issue has been you don't really have good one drops outside of your Skirk Prospector or your Goblin Lackeys, and so you have to look further up the curve, but at that point, you're often just casting one spell a turn, and you're not really cycling through your deck the way that you want to with something like this.
We just got to wait for Modern Horizons 3 to give us the free Goblin spell, and then we're all set.
Yeah, maybe a Fanatical Firebrand can be making waves in more formats as a result here.
Yeah, that card, I have a feeling it will not be making it any further than it already has. Sadly, they banned Roggevon in Legacy, so you can't even make that excuse.
Mm-hmm. Where do we want to go from here?
Let's see. Let's talk about Twinferno. This is, like, a really interesting card to me, and I guess it bridges into another card pretty well, which is a Haughty Djinn. So Twinferno is one in a red, and you choose one. You either give a creature double strike, or you copy the next spell that you cast, the instant or sorcery that you cast this turn. It's an instant, so it's a little not like it's, well, one instant speed, like, copy the next instant or sorcery spell this turn for one in a red is a reasonable rate for that effect. That's Galvanic Iteration without flashback cost. But, like, the line here is that this card pairs very well with, like, Crackling Drake and then Haughty Djinn, which is, or I think that's the translated name, but it's one blue for a Star 4 flying, power and toughness equal to the number of instants and sorceries in your graveyard, and also, your instant sorceries cost one less to cast, so it's Enigma Drake and Goblin Electromancer in the same monocolor card. So, like, that is a setup that makes a lot of sense there, where, like, you can cash in Twinferno with, like, whatever your card draw spell of choice is. Like, you can Twinferno into Treasure Cruise and just go off that way, or you can just have, like, a giant Drake in Twinferno and kill your opponent. And it's the kind of card that stitches together, like, multiple types of explosive draws. Even in Modern, you could see something like copy, I guess, like, not Iteration, but, like, one of the various spells out of Shadow. This could let you cash in, like, a bunch of different things that you could fit into that shell, while also being sort of a Teemer Battle Rage. Not quite as good, because the Shadow decks are less heavy on, like, the Gurmag Anglers, but you kind of see where I'm getting at with that.
Yeah, I already had a lot of interest in Crackling Drake as this cyborg pivot in the various Phoenix decks and other Izzet decks in Pioneer, and some people lead into that as their primary plan. Like, we're not a Phoenix deck anymore. We are a, you know, crackling Drake deck, and maybe we're pairing that with Saheeli, Sublime Artificer, or Favor of the Mirrorbreaker, stuff like that, to get this twin-style combo finish. And this fits very nicely in there, where it can turn a small Drake into a lethal Drake, or it can, like, you double up in your Treasure Cruise or something and overwhelm the opponent that way.
Yeah, this card is also really good with Divide by Zero when you set up, like, for that deck, where you just, like, copy Divide by... Like, I'm thinking of the Haughty Jin case, where, like, you are reducing the cost of this and Divide by Zero, paying three total mana to, like, counter a spell, bounce a permanent, get two cards from your sideboard, and, like, I don't actually know how your opponent recovers from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's focus on Haughty Jin for a second, because you could build an Is It Drake-style deck in Pioneer now, just based around this and Crackling Drake, and that might honestly be a good direction to pursue. Could also see this card showing up in just Is It Prowess, Is It Phoenix, just generally across the board. So once again, this is one blue-blue for an X4 flyer, where X is the number of instants or sorceries in your graveyard, so the Enigma Drake text, effectively. It also... reduces the cost of your instants and sorceries by one mana. So you have Enigma Drake in one color that also makes some of these like flashback Galvanic Iteration into Treasure Cruise lines a lot easier to pull off.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of interested in this card in Modern as a way to revitalize. Storm might not be the right way to describe it, but I think that you can... So we talked about, like, Grinding Breach, right? And I think that this is, like... When you start talking about the cards that enable the Storm deck, like Mana Morphos and Gifts Ungiven, I think it's a lot easier to build a functional package of those cards that is enabled by, like, Varal and Haughty Jin, which are just, like, much more reasonable cards to put in your deck. And, like, when you draw Gifts, it can just be a normal card you cast in the same way Breach is, but, like, also, like, Mana Morphos is a normal card. And you kind of see where I'm going with that, where it's, like...
Yeah.
You can build, like... a fairly normal deck with a combo kill that is not quite doing... Like, there's no Grinding Station in this equation the way there is in the Breach deck.
I think the pieces fit together a little less neatly, where you still are going to have a bunch of Desperate Rituals and Poetic Rituals in your deck and so on. And so, yeah, sometimes you're going to punk them out with a massive Djinn or something, but you still need both aspects in your deck at the same time, and those don't always fit together neatly. But I kind of like where you're going. And if we have another similar card in the space, and maybe you can build like a value Storm deck or something, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, I wonder if there's actually a setup that involves moving down the Underworld Breach line instead of the Past and Flames line there too, where, like, I haven't thought through all the details, but, like, there's also this natural, like, Thought Scour is a card that is good with a lot of the things going down on here. I don't know if the traditional Rituals and Grapeshot Kill is what you're looking for, is kind of what I'm saying there. So this card just, like, does a lot for what it... Like, it does cost a decent amount of mana to buy into. Like, a 3-mana, no immediate ability flyer that, like, doesn't have haste, just kind of has power and toughness, is kind of a big buy-in in Modern these days. But, like, the reward for untapping with it is really high.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about Inscribed Tablet.
Yeah, so this is a 1-mana artifact with 1 tap, sack. Look at the top 5 cards of your library. You can put a land card from among them into your hand. And then let's rephrase. It is not look at. It is reveal, because if you don't put a land card into your hand, you draw a card. But you have to put a land card into your hand if you reveal it. This feels like the card that all these colorless Tron decks have been looking for years. It's like the Ancient Stirrings to the Expedition map. You aren't quite to the Sylvan Scrying point, but, like, you're getting there. The only problem is it conflicts a little bit with Chalice, but at the same time, I feel like Chalice has gotten worse for values other than zero out of those decks. So, like, maybe that doesn't matter a ton.
It's a little worse, but you are allowed to play one drops in your Chalice deck. Not too many, of course, but I think people overstate how binary that is. You know, it's if it's 10 to 12, then probably can't do that. If it's 4 to 6, I think that's fine. You can get away with that. But I do wonder, so you have, like, Eldrazi Tron, you have the Prison Tron decks, but the advantage of those over something like All-In Classic Mono-Green Tron is that you are less reliant on assembling Tron. You don't need any specific combination of lands necessarily to do your thing. And this seems to lead more in the direction of, I am looking to assemble this land A and this land B every single game as often as possible.
Well, I don't think those decks are... You say that, like, they're not trying to assemble a specific combination of lands. They are. It just happens to either be Urza Tron or Eldrazi Temple plus other lands. Like, the hands where those decks have, like... It's like the classic, like, Cavern of Souls, Urza's Mind, Waste, Matter Reshaper hand. Like, you want to get as far away from that as possible. So if you just have, like, a bunch of Serum Powders, tablets, and maps... Especially, I think this is especially noticeable with the Prison Tron deck, where, like... It's, you don't even have the Eldrazi Temple hands as much as the Eldrazi Tron deck used to, because you just have a single Eldrazi card in your deck. So, like, being able to reliably have, like, Tron plus a Karn the Great Creator, like, or Tron plus a Walking Ballista, Tron plus, like, anything to do, I think that's a pretty big improvement.
Yeah, I do, so this is one to cast and one to activate, right?
Yep.
So there is a somewhat natural curve of play this on one, and then play something like a Mind Stone or an Everflowing Chalice or what have you on two, or, and then you still get to like set up for this big turn three. So I wonder how you can build a Tron deck from the ground up where I'm assuming you start with four of this, four Expedition map, and then I don't know how you fill in the rest or what your big hits to cast with all that mana even are necessarily, but maybe you can do that without having to do the whole... eight Chromatic Stars and eight Resurrings and Sylvan Scrying thing.
You see, when you say something like Everflowing Chalice, do you know what the next card I'm going to say is? Because I don't think 2022 is the time for Core Tapper, but you suggested
it's always
it
time
first.
For Core Tapper. It is always time for Core Tapper. Maybe we can work in some like Power Conduit, Urza Saga stuff in there. Actually, so this, you can find this with Urza Saga, and it's also decent at finding Urza Saga, like in a deck where, alongside your other Urza lands, you know, if you have another solid backup hit with it, then maybe you can build something without Starting Point.
Yeah, this all sounds like it naturally fits into the Power Conduit, a charge counter off of my Tendo Ice Bridge onto the Magistrate Scepter deck.
Yeah, I'm sure Aspiring Spike will have this on stream on a deck at some point before too long. Let's get on to some other miscellaneous cards here. Sten Paranoid Partisan. So this is a white-blue. You choose a card type, and that costs one less, essentially. So it's a build-your-own Goblin Electromancer for whatever type you want, and then you can pay one white-blue to flicker it to, I guess, mostly just save it from removal. And these effects are always worth keeping in the back of your mind, but they always seem to be a little worse than they are. So, like, I don't know if... I don't think you can play this in the same deck as like a Goblin, a Narcomancer or whatever, but that's the kind of thing I mean, where you look at it and your mind starts worrying with possibilities, but in reality, they just don't seem to materialize ever.
Yeah, I mean, so the problem for this card is that, Ethereum Sculptor has existed for a million years and did nothing with artifacts. We know exactly what happens with Electromancer and, Baral, so like, unless you wanted a non-red deck to have, like, eight Baral effects, it doesn't really add a ton there. Like, you could do, like, a Bant deck casting the green part of Metamorphosis, but not really here for that. So, like, what other card types are there? So we've got creature and land are excluded. Artifact, you know, are we naming enchantment with it? Because then that's just a worse version of, there's two cards from core sets that are just, like, one, like, two mana 2/2s that reduce the cost of enchantments with some other upside. So that's not going to work. So it's like Tribal or Planeswalker. I think that like when you go down the historical analogs list, you kind of realize that this effect is not unique. The only unique part is that you choose, but like the point of this is that all your cards are that type and they all cost less because this card exists. And like you could always choose something of that type.
Mm-hmm. This is the worst possible time for Scryfall to be going down mid-podcast here, so I'm really having to do a lot of this from memory, but I will move on now to a card which I think I have just about covered, and that is Cutdown. So I expect this to show up a lot, but I'm curious to see where your thoughts land on it. This is black for an instant. You destroy target creature whose power and toughness in total combined are 5 or less. So... You have the natural comparisons here with stuff like Fatal Push or Bloodchief's Thirst and so on. I think that in larger formats, Fatal Push is necessarily going to take priority over this a lot of the time, but are there weird edge cases that you can think of, or important ones where you would want this instead?
I honestly could not think. Like, I tried to think about this. Like, name a card that costs three or more that you need to kill that is smaller than a 3/3. And, like, I came up with Urza as one, and that, like,
sure,
that's a stretch. The problem is these days, like, you're like, oh yes, Grease Fang. Back in 2013, this would be like a 1/3, but today it's just a freaking 4/3 that just, like, has a billion power, would never die to this. Like, I don't really know what cards this is supposed to kill for one mana that Fatal Push doesn't. So really, you're talking about a card that, like, is debated against Blood Chief's Thirst as, like, do you care about instant that much more than killing more things? And I don't know. I'm not buying it on Cutdown anywhere outside of Standard.
That's a definite trend in recent sets, is that all of these enablers, which are built to be these build-arounds that do a specific thing, they all have decent stats just as game objects. And so if whatever your primary plan is offline, then, yeah, you can rumble in combat with your 4/3 Grease Fang, which I guess that one kind of has to be big so that you can actually through the vehicles it's getting back, but even for cards which don't have that very specific constraint operating on them, you see this across the board. It's all of these enablers are like 3/3s now, where, as you say, a decade ago, these would have been, you know, 1/3s, or they wouldn't have been priced to move in that sense.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's a problem is that a lot of the decks where you're just like, oh, I need an overload of cheap removal, it's like, okay, so I'm going to try to cut down my opponent's favorite Hoplite and really hope they don't have a Defiant Strike that makes it a 3/3. Like, that's...
Yeah. Well, like, yeah, same thing with that, like, Monastery Swift Spear, right? You get into these weird cases where anything that you wouldn't expect to normally be bumping up a power and toughness threshold does do it now with Cutdown in the mix.
Yeah, I think that the most offensive one might be Dragon Rage Channeler, because, like, you know, it works on Arena. It's totally fine on Arena.
It sure does.
Not that I ever cast a Dragon Rage Channeler on Arena. I'm just saying that, like...
Yeah, that tweet that someone had of they went to FNM and their opponent tried to like ping their Dragon's Rage Channeler with Renin 6 because on Arena it's a 3/1. Like, I assumed stuff like that would just be apocryphal and that it wouldn't actually ever happen, but it looks like at least somewhere in the world it is happening, and this is a real thing to be worried about now.
Yeah, that is kind of funny. I don't see Cutdown making the jump over to Eternal formats unless you really need an extra copy of, like, I don't know. I think Ray of Enfeeblement is a more likely card to show up in decks than that card.
Yeah, we saw in some of these formats very dominated by, like, Esper or Mono White, you would see some main deck Ray of Enfeeblement sometimes because there are just still a lot of X1 creatures around. You know, that still picks off a Llanowar Elves or something just as well as, a Disfigure does. So I expect this to be mostly marginal outside of Standard, like you said, but very glad that it, you know, exists for the people who want to cast it. Where do you think we should move on to next?
I think we vaguely touched on the idea of, like, temporary lockdown. You mentioned Pernicious Deed. Let's talk about the, like, closest thing to a deed we're getting, which is Karn's Silex. This is a 3-mana artifact. It enters the battlefield tapped. X, tap and exile it to destroy each non-land permanent with mana value X or less, activate only as a sorcery, and players can't pay life to cast spells or to activate non-mana abilities. Is it weird to think that I'm, like, more excited about the static ability, like, as a unique effect than the rest of the card? Like, obviously I'm playing this for the rest of the card because it's, like, the primary goal, but it feels like it's the kind of card that will really shine when that static ability is really good, and less so when you're just like, I'm in the market for a very slow card that I could just, like, play a Blast Zone instead of.
Yeah, people really like to try and line up stuff like this against, you know, fetch lands in Modern or what have you. I don't think you can be doing that in any kind of intentional way. You just incidentally benefit from that when it happens.
Yeah, it is very similar to the interaction of how, like, Bloodsun has not seen a lot of play in Modern, except for in the deck that is, like, I would like Bloodsun for my own cards, and the fact that my opponents can no longer fetch after I resolve it, that's the upside. I don't really know, like, what else it shuts off in Modern. Like, we aren't seeing a million Street Race, and they'll just cycle them in response. I don't know, where else are people paying life?
I really don't know. That's a good question. I guess in... Maybe in like a vintage workshop deck or something, you shut off the one Cataxian Probe in some of the blue decks, but that feels pretty marginal.
Well, I mean, turn one on the play, this card does, I guess, sort of shut... Like, that's pretty...
Shuts off Force of Will in those decks.
Yeah. shuts off Force of Will, shuts off fetches, and then when your opponent extends Moxes to play their cards afterwards, it KOs them, which is, like, cute. I don't think it's good enough, because I think that, like, the Workshop decks in Vintage have largely moved on to killing their opponent or, like, doing something Golos-y, but maybe I'm wrong. It's been a while since I touched that format.
Yeah, it joins the very long list of cards which are only somewhat playable because Mistress Workshop exists, and, you know, when you actually have to pay sacrifice for these things, no one has any interest. I think that, in general, a Sorcery Speed Sweeper where you have to even do that part, you have to pay mana equal to the mana value of the highest thing that you want to sweep up, I think that's just kind of a non-starter these days, where, like, again, you imagine this lining up against any of the premier threats we've seen in Standard recently. Like, if you're paying fee for this as a down payment, and then you have to pay five again to kill, like, a Goldspan Dragon or something right now, or, like, that just doesn't sound like anything I have any interest in.
Yeah, the Ender of the Battlefield tapped and sorcery is just, like, the real killer here. You don't even have the Oblivion Stone patterns where you're just like, I've hit eight mana, Oblivion Stone go, and, like, the game is locked up. It's like, I've paid three mana... I think does nothing, and then, like, I have to make the decision to act with my mana first. Just all around not great.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Resolute Reinforcement. So this is essentially a raise the alarm on a stick for the people who have an interest in that. This is one and a white for a 1-1 human, and when it and it has flash, crucially, and when it ETBs, you create a 1-1 soldier, and that soldier is not a human, so... This isn't two triggers for your Champion of the Parish or your Thaddeus Lieutenant, anything like that. But I can imagine decks which kind of want a raise the alarm fetch, but don't want actual raise the alarm, maybe having some interest here.
Yeah, my thought was, like, this is good with Collected Company. I haven't quite figured out why you would like a million creatures and, like, also Collected Company in Pioneer, but that is the route that this is going down.
Yeah, there's something like the Ban Humans deck, which already has both too many creatures competing for those slots, and too many two drops specifically. I don't know if it quite makes the cut, but in a similar deck that is trying to pair this with, like, Charming Prince or Extraction Specialist, this feels like a nice way to grease those wheels.
Well, there's also a... I mean, there's a couple different Selesnya cards from this set that could pair with this. So there's Queen Alindal of Ruradok. Yeah, whatever. We'll get Queen... Yeah, it's the... It's the Selesnya Uncommon. It costs white, green. It's a legendary creature, Elf Noble. Power and toughness equal to the number of creatures you control. And if you would create a token, instead create an additional 1-1 soldier on top of that token. So, like, that turns this into three bodies and a lot of power. But then there's also King Darien, the Super Bowl number. One green,
48.
White. What?
I think it's 48. And that was actually in the leaked set notes is, you know, this is how this part of the cartex works. And then the last thing was XLVII or whatever means 48.
Yeah, okay, good. Yes, like I said, it is in fact a Super Bowl number. One green, white, 2/3. Other creatures you control get +1/+1. So, like, obviously you're producing a bunch of power with your token generators. This is a human for, like, Thalia's Lieutenant. It's a reasonable company hit. And then there's even more text. So 3 green, white, put a +1/+1 counter on King Darien and make a 1-1 white soldier. And then sacrifice King Darien. Creature tokens you control gain hexproof and indestructible until end of turn. So, like, there is a, like, relatively interesting, like, glorious anthem with long game upside and inherent power and also, like, an anti-sweeper ability that promotes you playing a lot of tokens. So, like, there might be something going on with those cards in Company that allows you to slightly reshape the existing Company decks. But I think that you mentioned, like, this card does not inherently work with Thalia's Lieutenant as well as you would like it to. So there may be some readjustment to, like, yeah, we'll have Thalia's Lieutenant, but, like, what else are we doing to amplify the power of, like, we are creating two bodies for two mana. That's two power. Can we make that 4 or 6?
Yeah, I think in your Collected Company deck, it's really nice to have other flash threats you can company into so that passing the turn with open mana can represent lots of different things and make you even harder to play around. That said, I think if this card sees play, it's not actually going to be in a company deck. It's going to be in a low to the ground white aggro deck that's looking to go wide and then pump its team with stuff like, you know, Venerated Loxodon, right? Like you have the curve of one drop into this, into Loxodon on three, potentially with other stuff as well, or like Shepherd Dunes, or these, in general, these mass pump effects, I think, are the best thing to pair with this card. I know that Zansayed, for example, top six the team open in the Pioneer seat with Mono White Humans with four Legions landing in the main deck. And that's a perfect curve. If you have turn one Legions landing into turn two this, you're flipping your landing on three and then doing whatever you want with that mana. So I think you can find shells where this is really good, but I don't know if it's the first shells that come to mind necessarily.
Yeah, that actually sounds really interesting to me, and it flashes back to like the end days of, was that Reclamation Standard, where people had that super weird mono white deck that was just like all cards that cost one and literal Glorious Anthem, and you could probably make something along the same lines in Pioneer with this card.
Yeah, I don't know how good that would be, but it sounds plausible, certainly.
I don't think the current Rakdos like mid-range decks, and like especially in a Liliana era, are really built to defeat an opponent who's just showing up with like Legions landings and Raise the Alarms.
Yeah, if you can remove the first like big roadblock, whether it's a Kalidus or something or whatever, then yeah, it's pretty tough for a deck full of like Fatal Push and stuff to survive that.
Yeah. So what card do you have in mind next?
Let's talk about Llanowar Loam Speaker. So this is 1G for a 1-3. It taps to add any color of mana, but it also taps to turn a land into a 3-3 creature until end of turn. And so the combo here is with Jeskai's Ascendancy, where just in its own right as a mana dork, then it can be a source of mana to chain spells together on your combo turn, the same way that something like a Sylvan Caryatid can do, or Birds of Paradise, whatever. But the ability to animate lands means that you progressively generate more mana and then more big threats, which are already quite large, and then Ascendancy is pumping them with each spell you cast. And so you only need two or three spells before you're generating mana, netting mana with each spell you cast. And maybe you don't even need to cast more spells because you just have like a 4-4 and a 5-5 and a 6-6, and you can just get the job done in combat. So with the Pioneer Ascendancy decks, which have almost entirely dropped off the map at this point, I think largely due to the expressive iteration ban, but also just the rest of the format becoming more ruthless and more efficient as well. This is a nice thing to revisit in that context.
Yeah, that definitely sounds really exciting to make Ascendancy into like a true two card. Like it was with Sylvan Awakening, but this card is a little more functional than Sylvan Awakening.
Yeah, I imagine you still want some number of Awakenings, maybe even the full four still, and I don't know if this is a direct replacement for Sylvan Caryatid in those slots, or, you know, some lists had four Caryatid and then some Paradise Druids or something else on top, so maybe there's slots in there, but this is definitely earmarked for that shell, and I expect it to do good work there, even if, when all is said and done, that shell still is back on the fringes of the format.
Yeah, I think it just really depends on how good the backup way you find Ascendancy is. I don't know what the post iteration lists have turned to on that front, but that's really the missing piece I'd look for, is like if you have this in a Awakening and you can set up a reliable like two card combo kill that way, that's fairly scary.
Maybe you have to be communing with spirits or something at that point. You still have your opt and consider 8-pack, and you've got Treasure Coup, so maybe you can make do. But the advantage of iteration in that deck was not just that it's a great card, and it's a great card in a deck that has such a low curve, but also that when you were training together spells on your combo turn, iteration, it would dig deep, but iteration would be a set of triggers in its own right that would then find you usually at least one more set of triggers, if not two, and so that would let you really keep the chain going. But with Loam Speaker in the mix, there's less urgency to dig through your deck in search of that Sylvan Awakening, or to keep the spells going because that's what you need to do in order to get to lethal. So maybe, even though you're worse at finding Ascendancy now, maybe once you have Ascendancy, that's less of a problem now.
Yeah, again, it's just the having Ascendancy in the first place problem that needs to be solved. I kind of want to talk about a different combo enabler for Pioneer, and that's Astor Bearer of Blades. So this is 2 white red for a 4/4 creature with, when it enters the battlefield, look at the top 7 cards of your deck. You can reveal an equipment or vehicle card from among them and put it into your hand, and the rest on the bottom of your library. Your equipment have equip 1, and your vehicles have crew 1. So this is just a very efficient way to find a hammer, play a hammer, and equip a hammer in the format. Kind of almost like a Stoneforge Mystic plus Piercesteel Paladin setup. And there's actually like another very minor card that could fit into a sort of hammer shell that I don't know if it's quite pioneerable, but like it's the new Danitha. It's a 5-mana, 5/5 first strike, lifelink, vigilance, and when it ETBs, you can put an equipment from your hand or graveyard onto the battlefield attached to it. Sorry, 4/4, but like it's going to be a 14/14 first strike, lifelink, vigilance. It can also find auras, but less excited about that in Pioneer. But like, there's the makings of like a hammer deck that is not quite the modern equivalent. It's just like very, a little bit bigger and a little more like mid range with a combo finish.
Yeah, that weirdly, there's at least 3 different Boros 4-drops that all slot into a hammer shell in some capacity. So you have this, you have a Brunor Battle Hammer from AFR, which makes your equip cost 3 and then pumps your things for each creature attached to them. And then there's the Zendikar Rising Nahiri, the Boros one, which could both dig deep to find, I think, a warrior or equipment, and then would make tokens and attach equipment to them. So I think this new one is the best of its kind for those effects. I don't know how you fill out the rest of the deck necessarily. So you have Sigarda's Aid, that's great. So that enables some amount of these fast kills. But the virtue of the hammer deck in Modern is, even with all of the cheap cards available in that format, the comparative advantage is you still have this very low curve. You still get to have these double spell turns and still get underneath the opponents. And this deck is not really going to be able to do that. And so it's going to have to worry about the Khan, the Great Creator starts in mono green, or Thing in the Ice flipping, or what have you against Phoenix. Like, you have to care about the stuff that happens in longer games in a way that the hammer decks in Modern don't have to necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I would try to build the deck. So I'm thinking of like the standard Hexproof decks that had like Witch Stalker in them, where it was just like they had a bunch of stupid resilient threats, but also like a sort of combo Hexproof pump endgame. And I think that the Pioneer deck would want to position something like that, where like your threats are like, leave the like fast stuff to the heroic deck trying to double up on Illuminator Virtuoso. Just like play the cards with like that are the hardest for the whatever control deck or mid-range deck of choice in the format to kill, and like play like all the portable holes you want, and go down this road of just like being a mid-range deck with really pain in the ass creatures to kill that like, if things extend at all, you just have this big burst damage kill in the endgame.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Plaza of Heroes. So this is the base camp of this set, which will hopefully do more than that card ever did. This is a land. It taps for colorless. It also taps for 1 mana of any color, which you can spend only to cast a legendary spell. It can also tap for 1 mana of any color among legendary permanents that you already control. And then it has 3 and a tap, exile Plaza of Heroes, and target legendary creature gains hexproof and indestructible until end of turn. So this is a good land for the kind of deck that you obviously want to put it in, that also has some utility later on in the game. The question is, what does that deck look like? And so the place my mind jumps to is in, you know, Pioneer especially, can you find a crossover with a specific creature type such that this goes alongside Unclaimed Territory and Secluded Courtyard, and now you essentially have perfect mana to cast your legendary humans or whatever it is across 4 or 5 colors.
Well, my problem is that the reason to play a mono legend deck in Pioneer is Bard Class, and this, like, it doesn't, that card, like, inherently doesn't make you want to play a lot of colors, because it's like you would like to play cards that cost exactly red and green. The thing that comes to mind with this card is that there is a card type that is short and underrepresented on fixing like this, and that's Planeswalkers. So you have the, what was the one from War that, like, gained you a life whenever you played a Planeswalker and, like, forked your mana to play Planeswalkers?
Interplanar Beacon, right? And,
yeah, so this adds to that as another, like, 5-color way to just, like, merge a bunch of Planeswalkers into a deck. It also casts Karth the Lion, if you are going down that road. So I think that this is a sort of interesting way to extend that shell. The problem being that there's not, like, a good one mana way to, like, it's not like a one mana legendary Shriek Maw in Modern. So, like, this is not helping you cast the right interaction, but maybe you can align enough of your cards to put Solitude into your deck or something.
It costs Ragavan, I suppose. But it, if, yeah, it does also cast Oath of Nissa, which has the same, mana doesn't matter anymore effect on Planeswalkers, and crucially, Plaza of Heroes casts Oath of Nissa, because Oath is a legendary spell. So maybe there's some deck you can build that starts off with 4 Plaza, 4 Beacon, 4 Oath of Nissa, or some amount of those effects, and then just whatever smashing of Planeswalkers fills in the blanks from there.
Yeah, this is another point in time in this podcast that I am sad that Scryfall is unavailable as I continue to jam the F5 button and get a new error each time.
But when that tool is finally restored to us, then can have some fun building around this card. And so I think this is going to enable some really fun fringe decks, but I don't think that it doesn't add necessary redundancy to some deck which is like this exact effect away from being some tier one proposition.
Yeah, I I'd have to look through every single Planeswalker in Modern and think about that for quite a while. But just another reliable way to cast a fast Ren and Six without like a million fetch damage, and like also cast like, I don't know, Ren and Six into like a Liliana is kind of exciting. There's something maybe there, but it's again, it's going to take a full Scryfall search.
It kind of has to be specifically with the black cards, right? Because these four color decks are already well set up, even without Oath of Nissa or what have you, that you do see in some of them, to go Ren and Six into Teferi, into Omnath. And so when you can just already do that without having this land that doesn't cast Prismatic Ending, really, or Expressive Iteration, stuff like that, without these other requirements, then you would need to also want the black cards, and the black cards just kind of suck, so I don't know why you would want those.
I think that there's also, like, if you want to go Ren and Six into a double blue or double white spell, I think that that is restrictive enough, or, like, both, that you actually want these five-color lands to push you in that direction, as opposed to the four-color fixing. Like, the four-color fixing is very good at casting Ren and Six, Teferi, and Omnath, because they are all, like, very spread in the color commitments. It's not so good if you were, like, trying to cast... I don't know what the, like, equivalent cards, like, that are across, like, white-white, blue-blue, red-red, green-green, or whatever is. Like, I guess you have, like, all the evoke elementals, but those have evoke, so, like, it gets kind of dicey when you start thinking about, like, it is a black card, but, like, I would like Liliana of the Veil and, like, green cards with Ren and Six and, like, maybe a white card that I could cast off of this.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a new four-color or five-color deck will drop before too long. Until then, I will let the brewers do their work. Let's move on to what I expect will be the cutest one-drop in this set, and that's Phoenix Trick. So this is red for a 1-1 with flying and haste. It can't block. And then whenever you attack with three or more creatures, you can pay red-red. If you do, you return it from your graveyard to the board, attacked and attacking with a +1/+1 counter on it. So as a 2-2, effectively. This fills in that secondary or tertiary one-drop slot in Pioneer, especially, that we see occupied by some mix of, like, Fanatical Firebrand or Bomak Courier or stuff like that. I don't know if this strictly obsoletes any of those, but this is, it asks less of you than, if you have Swiftspear plus Soulscar Mage. Well, that's a great start, but it does require you to have a good amount of non-creature spells in your deck. This is just a fairly agnostic way to fill in that slot that doesn't ask much of you.
Yeah, I am more excited about this card in smaller formats where, like, it might actually be the highest quality one drop, because I think that the games in Pioneer where you ever return this, like, I do not understand how your one mana 1/1 flying haste creature that can't block is dying and then three other creatures you control are attacking.
That is the issue. You would need to have so many one drops that you are, like, curving one drop into double one drop or something pretty consistently. I guess this, the same way that, like, Karizev gives you this cheating discount on Embercleave, it does also... No, it doesn't. It doesn't even work that way. Damn it. Okay. Scratch that. Yeah, it feels like that last condition is not going to happen that much of the time, and the virtue of all of these other one drops is they can aspire to more, right? So your Swiftspear is going to attack for one some amount of the time, but it can also attack for two or three or whatever. If this is just a Flying Man, then Flying Man is not an impressive card for the most part.
I mean, I was playing with Tin Street Dodger and Standard, so, like, this card is well above my bare minimum limits, so, just, I don't think Pioneer is the place for it.
That's because you are a Tin Street hooligan.
Yes, that is, in fact, what has happened. So, I think a different one drop is kind of interesting to discuss here, and that's Evolve Sleeper. This is black for a... I mean, it's the latest figure of Destiny, right? So, black for a 1-1. You can pay a black to make it turn permanently into a 2-2. You can pay one and a black to make it into permanently a 3-3 Death Touch if it was a 2-2. And then you can pay one black to, if it was a 3-3, put a plus and plus one counter on it and then draw a card and lose a life. That last one you can activate any number of times. Like, it's a... It triggers on, like, card types to, like, become a Cleric and a Phyrexian. You know how these cards go over the years. It's, like, the same structure. But I'm kind of interested in this card plus, like, Knight of the Ebon Legion representing a scaling class of black one-drops that allows the mono-black decks in Pioneer to be sort of built more like a Delver deck where they are lighter on threats and higher on interaction because... Their threats are not something like Dreadwanderer that becomes quite as obsoleted over the course of a game. Like, Knight scales up really hard. This card scales up both in, like, actual cards and size over time.
Yeah, the mono-black aggro decks of old, which at one point were the consensus best deck in Pioneer, you could build one of those that is just 36 different 2-1s for one mana that recur themselves from the graveyard somehow, and like 24 lands, and that is a legal Pioneer deck you could build with help from another 1-drop in this set. And so 1-drops that do other things than that automatically look a little more appealing. So Knight of the Ebon Legion is a great example and has a spot for life in those decks, I think, and this could join that roster. So you have these 8 good 1-drops, and then you fill in the blanks with however many more 2-1s for one that you want to get to that required density. There is an issue, I think, of diminishing returns, which is that these mana sinks don't really play that well with each other. So if you have a knight and this card, then sometimes you will have to make tough choices between activating one or the other. Or if you have two copies of this card, then that's the case as well. So I think there's a lot to like about this. I don't know if it's going to be enough to bring that mono black shell back to viability or fix any of its fundamental problems. You could also consider this in something like a black-white human stick, which we've seen a little bit in the past. This lets you lean a little more into black, where once you have Secluded Courtyard that also counts towards activated abilities, and Concealed Courtyard, Godless Shrine, Cage of Koilos, all of the many benefits you enjoy being an enemy color deck in Pioneer, then maybe that lets you pursue that, but I don't know.
Maybe this is the card that Rakdos wants to be able to push its most aggressive draws, or you could rebuild as, like, a Dimir deck that has, like, this and Ledger Shredder as its low-end threats, and then lean into, like, Drown in the Lock and, why am I blanking on the name? Blue-black, draw two cards, discard a card if you don't have five costs among cards in graveyard.
Oh, Tainted Indulgence.
Tainted Indulgence, yeah. So, like, something like that kind of shell where you are... Again, like I said, this card reads like a Delver-style threat to me because the eventuality is, like, not only are you chipping away with damage, like, if you leave up mana, this grows and eventually starts drawing you cards to overwhelm your opponent as long as you have, like, generic one-for-ones to use with it. So, like, that feels like the direction I'd want to take that over necessarily, like, more, like, human-style aggression.
We've seen these effects throughout the color pie now, Ascendant Spirit being a recent example which never really found its footing in Standard and has only just now risen to prominence in Pioneer. Do you think that black as a color is more or less well-equipped than the others to leverage something like this, regardless of what the actual like costs and modes and scaling actually are?
It is... Let's see. Yeah, I think you are correct. It is probably less equipped than red, because red is really excited to, like, be able to, under the, like, it can, like, when you had a Figure of Destiny in a red deck, you could, like, play your other spells and be fine with a 2-2, or, like, go big on it if that was kind of what the game dictated, and, like, extracting value from a single card in terms of damage output is really exciting. Ascendant Spirit is just something else, where, like, it's the style of gameplay I was trying to push towards with, you know, discussing Evolve Sleeper with blue cards, where it's just like, oh yeah, if I just sit around with mana up, that's good for me. And then if they don't do things, that's also good for me. And like, that card is just absolutely bananas. But like, yeah, I think black is probably like middle of the pack. I think that green is one of the least excited colors because like, if you are, like, this is a classic, like, name a generic green 3-mana 4/4 that has underperformed over the years. There's, like, 8,000 of them because you don't want, like, a middling card that offers you, like, an amount of power for the most part, because your color is, like, largely about doing something bigger or getting you to something bigger, and, like, a Figure of Destiny equivalent doesn't do that unless it's Jiraga Tree Speaker. And then white is kind of just, like, I don't know. It's the same kind of problem where it's just a very additive color. So black is probably, like, dead center in terms of all the colors, in terms of, like, how good is a Figure of Destiny card generically in this color. Eh, worse than some, better than others.
I do wonder if our evaluation of these effects is anchored by Figure of Destiny being the first of its kind, where Figure of Destiny is really, really good at being a Figure of Destiny, and maybe that would not be as much the case nowadays. You know, maybe it was a creature of its time in the most literal sense, but like, I don't think any of these can really stack up to how good Figure was in both the red aggro decks and the white aggro decks in its time in Standard.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's one other thing I want to point out, which is that, like you said, the red decks and the white decks, Figure was really bad as a red-white card. Don't play Evolve Sleeper with, like, a curve of, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, because then you just are like, yeah, when my deck doesn't draw 1, 2, 3, 4, I can activate Evolve Sleeper. It's like, well, like, that just doesn't come together all the time. So, like, I would, if I was building a mono-black deck with this card, it's like, very tempting to be like Evolve Sleeper Liliana Kalidus. I don't think that that is going to lead to a good experience, and that exact kind of curve is why people have made fun of Rakdos for so long. I have some high hopes for this because I think the final mode on this card is powerful in comparison to a lot of the previous ones, but I'm willing to be let down there. I've got one last card I think is fairly important to discuss. I don't know how many more you have on this list. I guess we could, like, have the Pain Lands as a whole topic on their own, but as an individual yes. card, Sarah Paragon, a.k.a. Lures at Home, was the card that jumped out to me. This is 2WW for a 3/4 flying, and once during your turn, you may cast a permanent with mana value 3 or less from your graveyard, or play a land from your graveyard, and if you do, that permanent gains. When this would be put into a graveyard from the battlefield, exile it, and you gain 2 life. So, like, this is really close to, like, the natural Lurrus, but then plus some, right?
Yes, although, when was the last time you saw natural Lurrus actually in a deck other than as, like, a one-off something weird like Enigmatic Incarnation?
Well, so there's, like, a Vintage deck that plays a lot of them, I think. But that's a different story.
Sure.
I think that the ability of this card to get back a fetch land of some kind is actually kind of interesting, where, like, you play Sarah Paragon, you play your land from your graveyard, and, like, it's almost a micro Omnath in that sense, but, like, it's probably not the same level of value as Omnath over time, but it's also not the same color commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, so you mentioned Queen Alanel of Ruradark, I'm going with earlier. So this was the green-white-white elf noble whose power and toughness are each equal to the number of creatures you control, counting itself. And if you would create one or more creature tokens, then you get those and then a 1/1 soldier on top of that. I'm wondering if in Pioneer, given that you have this and Ginny Fae from Streets of New Capenna and the new Raise the Alarm on a Stick, I wonder if you could actually build, like, a collected company tokens deck where you can find these, like, multiplier creatures more reliably and also something to pair with them and just either rebuild your board post-sweeper quickly or just balloon an existing board out of control.
That's kind of interesting, especially because, like, this is another spot for Prosperous Innkeeper and, I guess, like, also Fable. That doesn't work with company, but, like, Fable sort of makes sense and, like, Innkeeper plus Ginny Fae makes sense, and, like, Innkeeper plus Company makes a lot of sense, too.
Yeah, or this plus, like, a Seeker's Chariot is a really nice curve, which I don't know if you can make the mana work, because this is double white, so curving, maybe with Brushland in 6 months or whenever we finally get that, maybe you can go Elvish Mystic into this, into Chariot or something, but I don't know, a man can dream.
Yeah, I'm currently desperately gathering and trying, and oh, this God, is how far I'm we've sorry. Fallen, to see if there's, like, if there's redundancy on this, like, ETB. I mean, you could play, there's a, Is Goblin the one in a red 1/1 that makes a Goblin token when it ETBs, is that Pioneer legal?
It sure is.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that was from Origins, correct?
I know that Simon Nielsen scammed his Pro Tour team into registering that in Standard, so I want to say it was more recent than that.
Okay, maybe 19. Oh gosh, Gatherer is just giving me a big spinny wheel. Everything's bad. So yeah, maybe we'll find out on a future episode when everything works what exactly you can do to build a Pioneer token stack. But the redundancy there definitely sounds exciting, especially since they're both legendary.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, as you alluded to, there is one big elephant in the room left to talk about, and that is, of course, the Painlands, which we already have in Modern, and no one plays them there, obviously, but for Pioneer, these are potentially game changers, or some of them are, at least, because once again, one thing that Wizards really love to do is to stagger these land cycles between sets, and you have to read between the lines in terms of which of these end up in which half. So, like with the Pathways, I don't know why Darkmoor Pathway was in Kaldheim where Branchloft Pathway was in Zendikar Rising. I'm sure there are reasons, but they are opaque to me. And likewise here, you know, we get Shivan Reef in Pioneer again for the second or third time. Gonna have to wait a while for Brushland to finally make its Pioneer debut.
Yeah, I think of the three that are in this set, which is Sulphurous Springs, a Darkar Waste, and Carplusion Forest. I actually wrote like a whole article about like what cards I want to cast off of them. And I believe the top two cards were both Carplusion Forest castable. That card, I think, is the big winner. I think that Burning Tree Emissary with that card is just like, that is everything you want to do with Emissary. It unlocks like a whole bunch of strategies where you're like Llanowar Elf into casting cards that cost double red and four mana and like all sorts of things like that. The other ones are a little tougher. I mean, Sulphurous Springs is just going to show up because it makes red and black mana, and you would like lands that are untapped that do that. A Darkar Waste, I can see, like, so this might speak to a different, I guess in a post-Liliana world it might be different, but after fiddling with the Artifact deck some, I think that they're just bad versions of the Boros Heroic deck, but it, like, a Darkar Waste is the card you need to stitch together Portable Hole and Ensoul Artifact. So maybe there is something there, but like I said, I'm not very excited about doing that relative to just, like, making a big, big Illuminator Virtuoso.
Yeah, in relative terms, these are a much bigger boon to proactive decks than they are to decks trying to play some kind of slower game. So there is an existing blue-white control deck in Pioneer, which gets to enjoy, Irrigated Farmland, which in turn lets it enjoy Glacial Fortress, on top of Hallowed Fountain and Deserted Beach, which is yet another cycle of lands, which is much better in slower decks than it is in aggressive decks. And then you have the blue-white pathway and so on. So I don't know that even in the 80-card versions of blue-white that a Dark Oasis is going to make the card or be a four of necessarily. But you look at a deck like Blue-White Auras or Blue-White Heroic or the various takes on in Sol, like a Darkar Waste is potentially a game changer for all of those.
Yeah, that's true. I guess something that I just thought about that is different than all these is that Scourge of the Skyclaves is Pioneer legal and like Painlands are a way to get to that. You'd have to figure out what, I mean, this might be the Evolve sleeper shell where you're like pinging yourself with Sulphurous Springs and also like casting a red one drop and then also like, yeah, there's something maybe potentially there to make Scourge playable in Pioneer, but it's tight.
There was a lot of interest in Death Shadow with Scourge of the Skyclaves in Historic, but it felt like the setup was never really there. So maybe once you have those and the Zendikar, like, mythic bolt lands, like Agadeem's Awakening plus Pain lands, maybe there's actually enough there to get all of that started now.
Yeah, and this might be a deck that isn't mono-red that gets to play Kumano Faces Kakazam, which has been, like, that card has been just absolutely phenomenal every time I've seen it in play from mono-red, but I think that the mono-red deck ends up at, like, 41 good cards and then a lot of bad stuff, and I would like to figure out a way to not build with the bad cards. Kumano Faces Kakazan, definitely one of the good ones, though, and it deserves better company, so maybe that is the split here, because, like, the ping helps you get off the ground with Scourge, like, all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, moving past a Darkar Waste, I guess we do have Underground River is not in this set, but I think of all the ones that you could exclude, this is the one that people would be least unhappy about, because there's no obvious shell for it. And like, there's blue-black control decks, which have the same dynamic as the blue-white control decks, where their mana is concerned. But there's no equivalent of the Auras decks or anything in the Dimir colors. I guess if you want to play like rogues or ninjas or something, if that's your jam, then Underground River will probably help you. But in terms of these decks which need to access either of their colors early in the game, and to that they're trying to overload on these colored one drops, nothing like that really exists in quite the same way. Maybe it could now, like maybe that's easier with Underground River in the mix, but I'm not seeing it just yet. More importantly, Carpluzan Forest, there have always been these like Gruul decks in Pioneer, which are kind of mopey, but just about function, where we have our Llanowar Elves and our Elvish Mystics, and we're going to use those to cast our Gruul Spellbreakers and our Bonecrusher Giants, and then maybe there's some Embercleaves or something at the top end. And those decks really wanted another good dual land on turn one, because Stomping Ground does a job. Okay, that one's good. Crackground Pathway, like if you're having to put that on green to cast your elf, then it's not on red to cast whatever your three drop is. And then Game Trail surely is not it, and gets worse and worse the more other lands you add to your deck. So those decks really could use a Carpluzan Forest, and they finally have one now.
Yeah, that's just a huge pickup. Like, yeah, Llanowar Elf mana bases were not built to cast Glorybringer even a lot of the time, and now this just makes it so that it works. Just cleanly works. You can, like, Llanowar Elf into Domri way more of the time. It's just really nice. I'll also point out one issue with Underground River that you didn't even mention, which is I lived in the standard format where I had to cast Thoughtseize off Underground River, and I don't want to go back.
Oof.
Yeah, I just don't.
Yeah,
we're good.
absolutely not.
Yeah, Brushland is probably, after Carpluzan Forest, the one that I'm second most excited for when it eventually shows up, and I think the Brothers War probably. There's just like a number of good green-white decks that could use a green-white land.
Yeah, a lot of it is color-shifted versions of decks which already succeed with the enemy color. So again, the Auras decks or the Heroic decks, you can very easily build green-white Auras. That curve of Glade Cover Scout into suit it up with a bunch of stuff, that is still very appealing, but the mana just has not been functional for that to work in the past, and maybe it is now. Or similarly, if you want to build these Llanowar Elf, Elvish Mystic decks that are casting these white three drops, that actually is a pretty appealing play pattern. But Elvish Mystic into Skyclave Apparition is not really a thing that you could do in the past, or Mystic into turn two Adeline or something. It maybe is now. It's still going to be difficult, don't get me wrong, but it's a little more doable than it was a few months ago.
Yeah, the pairing I'm actually interested in is Hardened Scales and Conclave Mentor, because Brushland stitches those together. But then a lot of the cards that you want for the +1/+1 counter side are artifacts anyways, so like you're fine tapping Brushland for colorless mana and not taking a billion damage. And it's like less, so you're describing these decks where it's like, I would like to cast Adeline on two and my second best land is a pathway, so it's a little dicey. Whereas the Hardened Scales deck is like, I don't know, just make whatever mana I need on turn one and then like play some colorless spell and it'll work out fine.
Yeah, my issue with... I would love any excuse to revisit Hardened Scales again. My issue with those shells is that after the Walking Blister ban, it's difficult for those decks to interact outside of stuff like Voracious Hydra or what have you. And so you end up in these spots where you just vomit a bunch of power onto the board, but other decks are doing that and then also interacting with you, or they're doing that better than you are, or they're like mono green devotion and they can just go way over the top of whatever you're doing past a certain point. And so when you don't have that ability to meaningfully interact, I think that deck is just kind of a non-starter for more reasons than the mana. But I would love to be wrong, and maybe you could build, like, if you have this artifact focus, then you have Portable Hole, and then Ingenious Smith, which you also want to play already, is finding your Portable Hole. So maybe there's a way to make all of that work.
Maybe we might be delving into nonsense territory here, and I think that any other previews we could talk about might strike that note. So do you want to just bridge from there to the Nonsense of the Week segment?
A very clean segue. There was one other card that I wanted to talk about, but I don't remember what it's called. And Scryfall is down, and my attempts to search for it via Google or what have you are coming up empty. So may have to table that one. It was essentially the 3-mana Gruul Legend that was Urza-esque in the sense that you know, all of your artifacts are Mox Emeralds instead of Mox Sapphires?
Oh, that one was in the release notes, so I don't know if it has any kind of, like, if it's not even on Scryfall, I think. So we might have to wait until we get the full spoiler and talk about some top however many lists next week to get to that one. But I do know what you were talking about.
We're officially memory holding that for the time being. I said nothing. You don't know that that exists. And when it does exist, we can all act surprised. But for now, let us indeed move on to Nonsense of the Week, where we have some interesting candidates here. So, yeah, we'll start with, I guess this is a Glimpse of Tomorrow deck, but we are going a little more off the deep end than even some of the other lists have.
Yeah, so this is Glimpse of Tomorrow. I guess, is it Elementals? Because I don't see Risen Reef, but it is, well, all the Elementals. Somehow Risen Reef didn't make it into the 80 cards, and Evolving Door did.
But we have another Elemental here in the form of a Vadrock, which lets you, I guess, mutate onto all of your various non-human creatures that are in the deck to recast your Glimpse of Tomorrow and go again for another round. So that's a lot of fun. And then, as you mentioned, the one copy of Evolving Door, which I was trying to figure out, is there some kind of actual, like, Birthing Pod-esque chain here? But there are so many restrictions on that card that I'm not sure you could build any kind of consistent combo finish there, even in a dedicated Evolving Door deck, which with one copy in 80 cards, this most certainly is not.
Well, it lets you turn any, like, one-color creature into a Shardless Agent. It lets you turn a Shardless Agent into a Vadrock, which is effectively a Shardless Agent. And then...
Huh.
That's, I think, where the chains end. But I assume that's what that card is trying to do.
That is adorable, and probably not good, but certainly adorable. We can take that part of the bank.
Yeah, I like the sideboard where you just have, like, Shifting Ceratops and Crawl Harpooner. I don't really know what Crawl Harpooner is. Like, do you think you're going to kill a Murktide Regent with that? I appreciate the thought. It's a good effort.
Someone lost to Modern Spirits and decided that is not happening to me ever again, and we are overloading on ways to solve that, including, I guess, the Mystical Disputes, which probably are not for that matter, but they can come in there too. Why not?
You joke, but Spirits did show up in 31st place in one of these challenges, so it's more likely than you think.
That said, this deck also has a Twinshot Sniper, which as a reach creature that kills things is pretty good there, and Brazen Borrower, and Subtlety, and we are a four main deck Fury deck, of course. So I think we have enough ways to keep the Ghostly Hordes in check here.
Yeah, let's move along to a Saga theme deck, which I feel like we may have covered something similar to this, but this might be the first time I've seen the Flame of Keld next to Urza Saga.
Yeah, or next to really most other cards in Modern. So this is, on its surface, just a mono-red deck with the trio that you'd expect, Dragonstrace Chandler, Ragavan, and Unholy Heat. We've got Mistress Bauble to go along with that. We've got our Urza Saga in our mono-red deck, so that part is not too surprising so far. Fable of the Mirror Breaker, sure, why not? That's a really good card in every format. And then we go a little bit off the deep end. So we have four Power Conduit to go with our, I guess, 10 sagas here. Our four Urza Saga, four Fable, two Flame of Keld. And then also Hex Parasite, which we can find off our Urza Saga to pair with our other surviving sagas. And then Hex Parasite, so this is one mana for a 1-1. And you can pay X and Phyrexian Black, remove up to X counters from target permanent. For each counter removed this way, it gets +1/+0 until end of turn. And that part is very easy to forget about. I have seen people attack into a Hex Parasite and just get blown out in combat because that trinket X slipped their mind. But so the gimmick here is you can effectively reset counters on your sagas each turn. So with Urza Saga, you can keep it in that stage where it's just going to activate and make a contract every turn, or in response to that third chapter, you can set it back to the second chapter, but that trigger will still go up. So you can effectively search for another Hex Parasite or another trinket of your choice every turn. Likewise with Fable, you can get that discard two, draw two mode. You can be making goblins and make treasures every turn. And then with Flame of Keld, again, you can just draw two cards, no discarding involved, or get that that damage boost on the back end as well. So lots of funky stuff going on here, as well as just the red one drops, which we already know are very good in Modern.
Yeah, the interaction between Hex Drinker and Fable of the Mirror Breaker is unfortunately not as favorable as you would like it to be. You do have to keep resetting it to one of the lower stages, That might be acceptable, though.
Yeah, and with Power Conduit, Power Conduit is a 2-mana artifact. It lets you remove a counter from a permanent you control, and so that can be any counter, any permanent, and then it lets you choose one. You can put a charge counter on target artifact, or you can put a +1/+1 counter on target creature. So once you have a lot of these counters scattered around, you can start making your Ragavan big so it can attack more easily and start connecting more. You can, if your Dragon's Race Channeler has been sent to the air, well, you now can build an increasingly large flyer. So lots of funky stuff you can do with that card on top of the kind of A plus B combination with any of the sagas in the deck.
Yeah, some interesting stuff going on here for sure. Like I said, Flame of Keld, not a card I expected to see, but I am interested to see the additional things you're doing with it here beyond just, like, hoping to draw two burn spells.
Yeah.
We've saved the best for last, haven't we, though?
Oh, yeah. So, from the creators of four-color Omnath Hammer, which we unveiled to all of you last week, comes five-color Omnath Hammer Reanimator?
Yes, that is, in fact, what this is. How are we discarding this Archon of Cruelty?
I think we are plussing our Ren and Six and then plussing it again and then discarding to hand size, as far as I can tell.
Okay, there's also two Fables, but yeah, that is, as far as I can tell, what is occurring. I guess Persist is also, like, a good way to get back Paladin against removal. This is just, like, a Hammer deck that has outright cut Sigarda's Aid, too.
Yeah, you can get back your Stoneforge Mystic as well. I guess technically you can persist a Noble Hierarch, but I'm not quite sure where that gets you.
Yeah, there's a lot of not persistable creatures in this deck for a deck with four persists. There's Ragavans, Omnaths, and I guess the instantly dying Noble Hierarch. So, yeah, some dicey stuff. It is approximately like three decks shuffled into one, but it apparently also went 3-0, so that is one win for each deck.
Well, you don't know if this is 3-0 against other decks built around the same philosophy or mindset. Like, I don't know what's going on over in Nagoya, if there's something in the water there or what have you. But, yeah, I don't quite know what to make of this.
Yeah, the fact that this deck list has aligned so that there is a column in the deck list of images, and the images are Bloodcrypt, Omnath, Colossus Hammer in a row, is really just great visual design.
Yeah, if you had to choose the MTG Goldfish thumbnail for this decklist, I don't think any of them could really do it justice.
Yeah, there's a lot of... Oh my gosh, this is a good grid draft. Like, you just choose one of these three or four card columns as, like, what do you want to show to someone off the top of your library, and the disparity between some of them is really great. There's that, and then just, like, a very normal, like, Hallowed Fountain, Solitude, Teferi one, and they're both the same deck.
This is like that classic between tournament rounds game of we'll just take our respective constructed decks and like shuffle them and then play off the top and see who wins. Except this is somehow a 61 card version of doing that with three different decks at the same time.
Oh, I didn't even notice the 61st card. That's nice.
Well, which do you think the 61st card is exactly?
Second Teferi.
Okay, sure. I was going to say maybe it's the one Magnetic Theft. Maybe it's... Maybe it's a second Solitude, actually. A few of those crept their way in there, too. I guess once you have Persist, you need some more things to actually target with that.
Yeah, it may be telling that there's an additional copy of that in the sideboard, so it's probably right there on the margin.
Yeah, we got some Furies in there, too, some Endurances, Prismatic Ending. We almost have the remnants of, like, a traditional four-color deck making up the numbers in the sideboard here.
Yeah, that is an accurate way. You can sideboard out of your deck into a four-color deck if you decide that you have had too much fun.
Yeah, if you get bored of the gimmick, or one of the many gimmicks, like, midstream during your match, then for your post-sideboard games, you can shorten the length of time that you have to sit through that.
Yes, if you would like to have additional ways to shorten your length of tournaments, you can listen to future Nonsense of the Weeks.
Yes, if you want to play Best of One with your 5-color Omnath Hammer Reanimator deck, and then do something more sensible for the other few games, then this lets you build that game mode into your tournament for yourself.
Yes, yes. I think that about does it for the week. We will be back next week with a bunch more talk about Dominaria United spoilers, maybe a new, if they have invented a 6-color, a new Hammer Omnath list.
We can work some Eldrazi, some wingdings into here, right?
Yeah, that is true. We do have a Dark Arwaste in new art to go with all of this.
Yeah, persisting Thornor Seer sounds like a good time to me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
All right, so until then, we will try and unearth some good nonsense and some actual factual Dominaris spoilers next time. But until then, take care, everyone.